Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 24 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we have the second part of George Miller's interview with Jeremy Seal, in which Jeremy tells George how he overcame his fear of deadly snakes and about his 500-kilometre journey along Turkey's Meander River by canoe. You can hear the first part of this interview back in episode 19.
My name is George Miller, and this is the concluding part of my interview with travel writer Jeremy Seal. You'll remember that Jeremy had fixed on the bizarre history of the Fez as a subject for his first book. This piece of headgear, generally treated as a source of comedy in the West, was in fact the focus of an ideological battle over the future of Turkey, where it was seen to epitomise conservative reactionary values. Jeremy takes up the story.
What was really interesting, what I discovered, which particularly interested me, was the fact that as Ataturk had identified the Fez as his problem, so an earlier leader of the country had identified the Fez as his solution, as a replacement for the turban, which in the 1840s, an earlier leader, Sultan Mahmud II, had seen as a bulwark to his own attempts at modernization and change. So the turban was removed in the early 19th century, by the Fez, which by the early 20th century had in its own time become a symbol of reaction, which Ataturk felt he needed to get rid of. So there was this extraordinary hat story running through the politics and the culture of the country, which these leaders identified as holding the country back. So this was the story I wanted to tell as a means of throwing light, if you like, of illuminating the tensions in Turkish society, which even today exist, between these two traditions. Tradition of old orthodoxy, reaction, tradition on the one hand, and the tradition, if I can call it the other word, of change, of modernization. And Turkey has always been caught between these two ideas.
When you were planning that book, did you sort of draw up a list of places you wanted to go in search of the Fez, places which had been significant in its history, and then set off in pursuit of it?
Yes, I did. Because I had a very particular subject, I wanted to identify places which had played a role in the history of that particular object, in that particular item. And among them, for example, were Fez factories in Istanbul, places where fezes had been made in Istanbul, places in the interior where Ataturk had given speeches condemning the Fez and at the same time recommending the Panama hat or the Homburg or whatever it was that he felt should be its replacement. So as far as I could, I was consciously going out of my way to create a framework, a geographical framework at least, in terms of where I was going to go and set the story.
But at the same time, I suppose you didn't know just how elusive the Fez was going to prove. It is quite an elusive beast, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I was looking for an object that I knew had been banned some 70 years before I was actually doing the travelling. So I didn't really know what I was going to find, and I didn't really know what the value was in that idea of looking for a Fez. Was I looking specifically for an actual object, or was I looking for what it came to mean? What was I looking for? And I did find it. I found it as a tourism trinket, and I found it time and again as a tourism trinket. And what was interesting was that Turkish people are able to have two ideas of the Fez and to separate them entirely despite the fact they were exactly the same object. The Fez as sold to a tourist was one thing. The Fez as worn in anger, if you like, by an Orthodox Turk was entirely a different thing. And it was still the case in the 1990s, in fact until quite recently, that anybody wearing a Fez, as I say, in anger, in political sincerity, was in danger of being criminalised for doing so.
And I was trying to think of an analogue, and I thought, well, the kilt has possibly some significance here, because to Scots. It is a symbol of some nationalist pride. Obviously, it's not got the religious connotations, and at the same time, it's debased and used as a sort of, you know, it's used in tourism. But that doesn't go nearly as far, does it, as the fez goes into the sort of Turkish psyche.
That's interesting you mentioned the kilt. I was thinking about that because it is probably the case that for a non-Scot, the wearing of a kilt at some tiny level does suggest a kind of nationalism and, by extension, a discomfort with the Union at some very, very mild, modest level. Yeah, I mean, a Scot wearing a kilt in England would partly suggest fun, but it suggests something at a tiny level too, doesn't it? It suggests something about identity. I think the fez in Turkey was to an entirely different level. It had been identified, as I say, as the uniform of the orthodox reactionary opposition. It was identified with the Ottoman Empire. Good Ottomans wore the fez. And when the time came to dismantle the Ottoman Empire, which is what, after all, he was going to do, the fez was one of the first things, one of the most visible things that he had to hit.
I suppose the lack of analogues in this instance, but also in lots of other things which your books bring out, is part of the fascination of Turkey, isn't it? You can't say what Atatürk did there was just like what happened in Nasser's Egypt, or it's just like it is. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's unique. It's a uniquely fascinating, complex country, it seems to me.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's why I was so drawn to it. There is no analogue for that, as there is no analogue for the longevity of the posthumous Atatürk cult. This goes on and on and on, and nowhere else has anything like it. People get removed, however long they survive. And you think of Stalin even now. There are parts of Georgia where you may occasionally see pictures of him in very old people's houses. And it's probably the case in parts of China, although I don't know the country well, that you will still see pictures of Mao. But Turkey, he is still state enshrined. He's absolutely everywhere. There are almost no statues of anybody else in Turkey other than Atatürk. He is on the banknotes. He's on the coins. His name has been given to forest farms, to airports, to universities, to military academies, to almost everything you can imagine. His picture is in every state office. It is quite extraordinary how intact the Atatürk cult is. Well, 1938 he died. So, you know, we're talking a lifetime now after his death, and he's still there. And I think that is partly the problem. It's rather like a dam. When it goes, when they start to take it apart, there's going to be real trouble, it seems to me, because there is nobody in Turkey who has not grown up under the avuncular, the fatherly, the patriarchal eye of this extraordinary figure. If you insult Atatürk in law, you know, you are criminalized by that. So he's untouchable, in a sense, and yet the current political party in power is, it seems to me, covertly beginning to at least dig at the foundations which support this man and this idea and this cult.
So tell me what it was like researching that first book. Did you think that this is it? I found my métier. This is what I've been destined to do.
No, I mean, I don't know whether writers often feel like that. I didn't feel terribly confident about it. I was looking for two things. I was looking for information relating to my main subject, which was the fez, but I was also looking for, I was also looking to portray, to convey Turkish, mainly rural life. I was looking just for encounters with people. So those two things were happening at once. And I do remember there often being situations where I would, for whatever reason, get myself into a situation where I was talking with local people and it was going well and I knew the material was wonderful and I could see the place that that would have at some point in the finished book and feel a real satisfaction with that and feel that I was beginning to learn the craft. But I didn't feel I'd worked out my métier at all. I didn't have any sort of sense of this being the first in a series of books on Turkey.
And the book was very well reviewed. It was shortlisted for prizes. It's continued to sell to this day. So once it was out there and it was doing well, did you think, okay, I'm a travel writer. What can I do next?
Yes, it did do well. I mean, it sold well. I think the timing was good. Turkey was just emerging then. the idea was strong and people were very kind to it. And I think it had this memorable, if nothing else, title. So it had a fair amount going for it. And it was also the time, I think, when Travelogue was still very, very popular. There was a market for it and it sold well. And that was massively gratifying. And then something odd happened. It didn't strike me that I could write another travelogue about Turkey. I'd done my Turkey travelogue, and I sort of assumed then that it was time to go sideways and find another subject. I think a lot of travel writers do feel that you know, you can write write to a certain amount about one place, but actually the whole point of being a travel writer is that you will cover a whole raft of destinations. So I went away and waited for the next idea to come to me. And the next idea, utterly separate from Turkey, was to write a book about another subject which had long fascinated me in a very different way, which was deadly snakes, deadly snake cultures, and that sort of phobic fear that I'd long, long had about snakes. I wanted to explore that whole subject in the context of the cultures which struck me as being most interesting in terms of deadly snakes and places where there were particularly large numbers of particularly deadly snakes. So I wrote a book which effectively had four narratives, and they were based in Africa, in Australia, in the American South, and in India. And what I was looking for were these cultures where snakes had a very pronounced role in ritual, if you like, in kind of modern, everyday ritual, often in very marginalized, superstitious communities. I thought, this is great material. So, for example, I wrote about the snake-handling churches of the American South. And these are called the Holiness Churches, who base their belief on a couple of lines in Mark, in the Gospel of Mark, which talk at great length about true believers being able to take up serpents. And this is something that these country churches have taken literally, and they take rattlesnakes and copperheads into their churches, and in the course of services they throw them up and down, they tread on them, they effectively invite the snake to bite them, and they take from the fact that the snakes don't bite them an endorsement, if you like, of their belief. And it is phenomenally colourful, bizarre and disturbing material.
How did you get on, I have to ask, with your fear of snakes by the end of the project?
Bizarrely, it worked. It really worked. Prior to going there, I was properly afraid of snakes, to the extent that even in the UK there were places where I knew at the back of my mind I didn't want to go because somebody had told me that there were adders there. Never thought about it since. I went to these places, and I think it worked. I mean, there's obviously a name for this kind of therapy where you sort of are exposed to what it is you fear to such a degree that you have to get over it. And I did. I mean, in India, I went to a cobra-worshipping festival in Maharashtra. And in the course of that festival, local people with cobras will come round and they will knock on your door. And I was staying in a little onion shed at that stage, so there was nowhere else in town I could stay. And they will come in, and they will put the snake down in your room and invite you to stroke it. And you give them a bit of money, and away they go. And in the stroking, there's a kind of blessing, apparently. And I did that. Inconceivable to me I would ever have done that prior to this journey. But because I was so immersed in snake cultures, by the end of it, I found myself thinking, this is all right. And it's actually, it's a fear and a fascination. Interestingly enough, while the fear's gone, the fascination is to an extent gone too. It's almost as if by dealing with the fear, I lost something in the process of doing that.
And I suppose that's a challenge of a fairly extreme kind, of confronting a fear such as that. But is setting yourself some kind of challenge always part of the book, of some kind of confrontation with something that is unknown, or opening yourself to something of that sort?
I don't think so necessarily. I think the reason I wanted to do the snake book was not because it was in and of itself a challenge, but because I recognised this was good material. I mean, I think it's as simple as that, actually. In the same way that I thought about the Fez book, that will work. From the storyteller's perspective, I can see that will work. I could also see that, you know, this idea of deadly snakes was something which would chime with a lot of people. I thought it would work. I think in my latter books, there are latter books which don't have a challenge in them. They have a subject or they have an approach, but the challenge isn't integral to the whole thing. I don't see myself as somebody whose travels necessarily are about proving myself in any sort of sense.
But nonetheless, there is a challenge built into your most recent book, Meander, in that you have to navigate your way through 500 kilometres of a river which is badly mapped, I think it'd be fair to say, inadequately mapped. So at the start of that, you couldn't possibly have known, well, it wouldn't, to use a cliche, it wouldn't be plain sailing, would it?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And in a way, that book is an exception in that it's more expeditionary than any of the other books. You know, at some level, it appears like an expedition. It's about attempting to get from the top of a river to the bottom of a river in one piece, and doing it in its entirety, whether I'm in a canoe or whether I'm walking or whatever it is I'm doing. So yes, you're absolutely right about that. But contrary to that idea is the fact that I wasn't aiming simply to get to the end. I was more interested in the bits in the middle. The whole point of travelling a river called the Meander is, of course, to meander, is to allow oneself to be distracted, to relish the digression, to see the route of the river as a means not to the end of the river, but as a means of going sideways into the wider culture and history of the land. So while the book has the classic shape of an expedition, trying to get from the top of the river to the bottom of it in one piece, I'm more interested in the bit in the middle, which is where this meandering river takes me in terms of digressions and distractions, in terms of stories, in terms of the history of the land.
You say something early on in the book, I think, about recapturing the virtue of aimlessness in travel. Is that something you felt perhaps you had been in danger of losing?
Yes, absolutely. When I think about particularly the first two books, I am aware that they were absolutely predicated on a very, very, on an idea that could effectively be summarized as a phrase: finding the lost band hat, or overcoming my fear of deadly snakes by spending time with snakes, which has a virtue, but I think it also has a problem in terms of good writing. The virtue is that it keeps your focus very close, and you know where you're going, and the reader knows where you're going, and it's very easy to get the point of the book. I think the weakness, if there is one, is that it means that you're not looking sideways at any point. You're always looking, you've got your blinkers on, you're heading in one direction. And it may be that you're missing all sorts of wonderful material which is off to either side of you as you're making this journey. And this Meander book allowed me to do precisely that. That was the whole point of the book, in a sense, was that it was saying there is no prescription here. There is no agenda. This is a river which, by its very name, not only invites you, but almost insists that you go where it takes you. And I was very taken by that, because it seemed to me that it was almost in that move from the sort of books I'd written before to this book, there was a kind of encapsulation of two very different approaches at the two extremes of travel writing. Where do you pitch yourself? What's your subject? You can't look at everything. What do you want to look at? And how do you set up the rules, the protocols, whereby you decide what's going to be your subject in terms of the territory that you're moving through?
And what am I going to say about me? I mean, to what extent is that a question that you have to explicitly ponder, and to what extent does that emerge from the whole process?
It's funny, because I've spoken to all manner of travel writer friends, and they often talk about this idea of writing oneself as a travel writer out of the book, which, while it seems to me laudable, I can understand why they want to do it, that if you can portray the landscape through which you're travelling, through your eyes, but without you being at the heart of it, it's a beautiful conceit, it seems to me. But I'm not sure that anybody has ever succeeded in doing that. A lot of Colin Thubron's writing seems to me to do that, but you're still aware of him being there. And it seems to me that a travelogue is by very nature centred on the person doing the travelling, and I think it needs to do that. So I'm definitely in my books to a greater or lesser degree. I would say probably, compared to other travel writers, to quite a high degree. I mean, I'm aware of the personality, sometimes the constructed personality, that I am at the heart of my own book. And I'm aware in the Meander book, for example, that I am this slightly buffoonish character attempting something which is going to be difficult, not only because I can't get the maps and because nobody's done it before for obvious reasons, i.e. the river is blocked, there are blockages. So I wanted to kind of give a sense of a real person with real issues travelling through this landscape. And some of the issues are entirely practical ones. How do you, at the end of a day on a river which is smelly, commend yourself to get a free night's accommodation in a village where you've never been before? How do you do that? Do you just turn up and say, have you got a bed for me? So all that had to be in the narrative. I couldn't simply describe the village where I'd arrived at the end of the evening without explaining the context of why I was there and what I needed to get out from it, out of it.
Tell me a bit about how you prepared for that journey, Jeremy, both sort of practically and intellectually.
Okay. In terms of practical preparation for this journey, for the meander journey, the first thing I needed to do was to work out how I was going to travel. And I wanted to do it by canoe. I wanted to do it by canoe because it seemed to me that to really get close to this river, I needed to be on it as far as was humanly possible. So I set about purchasing a foldable canoe, and I then took it down to the River Avon near me in Bath to at least try it out, because I've done a bit of canoeing in my life, but I'm not a very accomplished canoeist. And I was aware that it would be quite useful to at least have a sense of whether I was any good at this thing before I committed myself to a long journey on my own down a river. Now, that may sound a little bit reckless, and actually, in hindsight, I think it probably was. I think I allowed myself to believe that because this river was called the Meander, that it would present no dangers to me in terms of white water or fast-moving water or anything, that I need to be, that it was going to be a very, very gentle river. That wasn't entirely the case, it turned out. So I spent a couple of days in my canoe on the Avon, paddling around, getting a sense of whether this thing was, for example, stable, how easily manoeuvrable it was. And then I began to think about other issues. What kit did I need to take? Because, as I say, this was an expedition in a way that other ones hadn't been. On previous trips, I simply packed a bag and off I went. On this one, I needed kit. I needed to think about what I might need when I was out on my own, how I would feed myself, and all these issues. So there was quite a lot of thinking about kit and working out how much of that kit I could get into this canoe. Lots of logistical details. As for the emotional preparation, I think it was predicated upon the fact that, A, I felt pretty confident, knowing Turks as I do, that people would be likely to put me up in the course of my journey, and that therefore I could at least contemplate or countenance the idea of a journey whereby at the end of each day I would be in a place where there were no hotels. There was no hotel or pension or any place which was in the business of offering accommodation.
There's no pre-existing meander tourist trail. All the icons and the maps are fictitious.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, nothing at all. The meander is a river which tourism has completely and utterly ignored. That's the case with a lot of inland Turkey. You know, it's simply the case that unless there's a very big major ruin there, there won't be any kind of tourism trail. All the tourism is around the coast, apart from Cappadocia, which is a big tourism area inland. And while there are one or two reasonably well-known ruined sites close to the Meander Valley, there was nobody on or near the Meander River at all in terms of tourism. I mean, it was just simply not the case.
I was struck looking at both Meander and Affairs of the Heart. In the earlier book, you're fairly dismissive of ancient history. You say basically it hadn't really spoken to you.
Yes.
You hadn't really had that connection. Mm. Clearly, by the time you came to the Meander, that had all changed.
It's very interesting you mentioned that. I was rereading the Fez book last night, and I was very struck. I was quite surprised by that particular section. There is a section where I talk about ancient history and my inability to make sense of it, or for it, as you say, to speak to me. Over the last 25 years or so, something dramatic has changed, because I've found myself increasingly drawn to ancient buildings, to architecture, to ruins, to ancient history. I remember a very good friend of mine saying, precisely on this subject, saying, as I get older, all I want to do with my holidays is visit ancient ruins. And that seems to have happened to me too, to the point where I mean to engage much more closely with ancient cultures in the Meander book than I do in the Fez book. The Fez book focuses, as much as it does historically, on the period at the very beginning of the Republican era, you know, when the Ottoman Empire gives way to modern Turkey, and particularly 1925, when the pogrom, if you like, against the Fez is instituted. The Meander book does something very, very different. It attempts, as far as it can, to tell the overall history of the region from the earliest historical beginnings right through to the modern day in the course of the journey down the river. So it's much more ambitious in terms of its scope, but I do feel over the last 20, 25 years that I have educated myself to quite a considerable degree, given what I was saying in the Fez book, to architecture and to history and to particularly the classicism of Western Turkey, Western Asia Minor.
Jeremy, we've talked about the divisions in Turkish society and some of the historical reasons for them, and I know you've very recently been there, and the political instability is ongoing. I wondered if in conclusion you could just offer some thoughts about the future, how you see things, what the possibilities might be for Turkey in the next few years.
I think that there is certainly an issue, and the issue is that it seems to me a revenge culture of sorts exists and predominates in Turkish politics. The 20th century was about the Western secular elite imposing what they wanted upon the reactionary, rural, village masses, if you like, and getting away with it. The 21st century may well be about the boot being on the other foot, that the Islamist movement, under a democracy, they know they have the mandate, they know they have more votes. And the question is whether they are prepared to seek a consensual arrangement with the secularist urban minority or not. Do they want to fight or do they not want to fight? I don't know. My suspicions are, to a degree, they do. The current Prime Minister seems to me to be fairly confrontational. He remembers that he was imprisoned when he was the mayor of Istanbul for making various Islamist comments. And I don't think he's forgiven the opposition. So the question is, what will happen next? I hope that he and the opposition will look at what's happening in Egypt and think that is where we don't want to go, because it's almost like the Turkish situation is a diluted version of exactly what is happening in Egypt. Exactly the same situation. So an Islamist majority facing down or being faced down by a secular minority. The real question is, what does the army do? And I suspect if Mr. Erdogan, who's the Turkish Prime Minister, has any nightmares, it's about unrest reaching a point where he needs to call on the army. Will the army come in on his side? I doubt it, because in the past, they've traditionally sided with the secularists. So there is this ongoing, intractable problem between the two traditions in this country. And I just hope that, if only because they don't want to experience what is happening, for example, in Egypt, they will realise that they need to find a compromise. There needs to be a way to find a compromise. But what that would need to accept is that the Islamists will need to be very statesmanlike and say, you know what, although it's our time now, what we can't do is, if you like, the equivalent of what the secularists did to us all through the 20th century. We need to, at this stage, find common ground, find a consensus so that both traditions, if you like, feel that their values and what they stand for are respected.
That was Jeremy Seal in conversation with George Miller. You can find out more about Jeremy on his website at www.jeremyseal.com. And that concludes episode 24, which was recorded and produced by George Miller. Coming up in episode 25, we have My Other Career, an inside look at the diverse and surprising ways in which contemporary writers support themselves beyond their writing lives. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.